Disc 6.
Michelle's Story, The Enlightened Way to Wealth, read by Daryl Allen.
Michelle was always grateful that her children weren't in the house when she noticed the red light blinking on the answering machine. It was her husband, Gideon, calling from his car to tell her he'd be a little late getting home. Nikki and Hannah never heard how their father's cheerful rendition of Puff the Magic Dragon, intended for them, was interrupted by the jarring screech of his brakes, of metal against metal, of cars colliding. Michelle, alone in the kitchen, while the kids scampered happily around the backyard with their small menagerie of pets, played the message over and over, hoping it would end differently. She learned later from a grim-faced state trooper clutching his hat in his hand that her husband had been the only fatality of a four-car pileup. The drunk who caused the accident spent a day in the hospital and then was released to his girlfriend. Most of the town of Deer Creek, Colorado, came to the funeral. Michelle's friends arranged a wake at her house following the trip to the cemetery. Michelle sat in a folding chair in the living room. On her lap, she balanced an untouched plate of spanakopita and fruit salad that her friend Summer had handed her. With her eyes lowered, all she could see were anonymous bottom halves of people milling about. Slowly, she registered that a couple was approaching, a man in a black suit and a woman with dimpled knees under sheer black hosiery, Gideon's parents. Reluctantly, Michelle looked up. Anthony Erickson stood over 6 feet, his wife just a few inches shorter. Anthony's strawberry blonde hair was only flecked with gray and so abundant that Michelle suspected a transplant. His eyes were swimming pool blue. Natalie, with the help of a face and eye lift, radiated an imperious beauty at 60. The Ericksons had always disliked Michelle, and it had been difficult for her to not return the sentiment, though she had been as polite as possible for Gideon's and the kids' sake. But seeing them now, she felt a stirring of pity. They had lost their only child. They stopped in front of her. Anthony stood stiffly. Natalie looked around as if to see who was watching them. Michelle didn't know what to say. "I'm sorry" is always best in situations like this, she thought. Maybe that's what they would say to her, too. Then Natalie whispered, "You know, dear, I would have been happy to help you buy something nice for Nikki and Hannah to wear to their father's funeral." Michelle remained speechless. She glanced over at her children. They were in a favorite spot next to the fireplace, Nikki holding Hannah's hand. She had heard him say to his sister that morning, "I'll be like your daddy now." With her free hand, Hannah held Mr. Moo Moo up to her cheek. Mr. Moo Moo was the yellow and pink blanket that Michelle had crocheted for her while she was pregnant and hoping for a girl. Nikki was a precocious 7-year-old, a serious reader, excellent in math, and reflective to the point of almost being somber. He loved sports, especially baseball. Hannah was 5 and completely unaware that she was stunning, with curly auburn hair and radiant fair skin. Her appearance favored the Erickson side. Michelle had straight brown hair, brown eyes, and an olive complexion. Hannah was bright, like her brother, but she did struggle with shyness. That struggle was on Michelle's mind when she said weakly, "I'm a good mother." "We can see that," Anthony observed, looking toward Nikki, and a small bandage he'd sported on his forehead, the result of an errant line drive he'd tried to field only days ago. "He was playing baseball!" Michelle raised her voice now. She had felt guilty, had reproached herself that day all the way to the emergency room, would probably still be thinking about it if it hadn't been for... "We'll make this brief," Anthony said crisply. "It's no secret that you weren't our first choice for a daughter-in-law." "You weren't exactly my first choice either," she thought.
"I always saw Gideon as taking over Erickson Timber, before you entered the picture. Now he's gone."
Michelle had been trying so hard not to cry, but now the battle was lost, and the tears rolled down her cheeks. A few grapes slid off the plate in her lap. She patted down her loose-fitting plum dress, one of the few dresses she owned, but no pockets, no tissues. "He never wanted Erickson Timber," she whispered. "The bottom line is, we have one thing left to us," Anthony retorted. "Just one. Our grandchildren. And Nikki is my last chance for an Erickson heir."
"What do you mean?" Michelle asked.
"This isn't the right time, but there never will be a right time," Anthony said stonily. Although he gave no perceptible signal, a black-suited man with gray hair suddenly appeared from behind Anthony and handed Michelle a sheaf of papers. "Mrs. Erickson, I'm serving you with a legal document," the man said in a practiced tone, quickly stepping away from her. Michelle cautiously placed the papers on the coffee table. The words, "Erickson versus Erickson," in larger letters at the top, leapt out at her. But her head was throbbing too hard to try to read anything, let alone legalese. "We want custody of the children," Anthony said. A leaf fell into Michelle's lap. A leaf fell onto Michelle's lap. "Autumn, everything will die." On Courtney's deck, Michelle sat in a wicker chair, looking out at the yard below, where a few flowers still bloomed. There were marigolds and petunias, although the pink and reddish-purple pansies were no longer vibrant. She caught the look that Courtney and Summer were exchanging. "I'm all right," she said. "It sure helps being with you guys." Courtney Dillon and Summer Bindman were two of Michelle's oldest friends, natives, as was she, of Deer Creek, and classmates from high school. Summer was a sweet, naive soul whose nurturing personality served her excellently in her job at a senior center. Courtney was the practical one of the trio. A few years ago, she had opened her own craft store, The Feathered Nest, which sold work by local artists and craftspeople, such as paintings, ceramics, and the quilts that Michelle loved to make. "We're worried about you," Courtney said. "Whatever happens, you can't give up," Summer encouraged her. The two women sat on the opposite side of a table set with tea things. Summer could have passed for a teenager from a distance, with no makeup to cover her abundant freckles. Courtney, as usual, looked as though she had stepped out of a Talbot's catalog in a tweed skirt and twin set. "Things are looking a little grim at the moment," Michelle said. She tried to speak lightly, but what she had to say only depressed her more. Michelle was insolvent. She and Gideon had taken out a second mortgage to help launch Gideon's gadgets. He was gifted at designing clever, useful things, although the company hadn't quite taken off the way they'd hoped. He was on his way home from showing the prototype of his latest gadget, a futuristic cell phone holder that no one seemed to want, when he was killed. As budding entrepreneurs, Michelle and Gideon were good at the creative part, the brainstorming, the fun things of running a small business, but less effective when it came to the mundane tasks, like bookkeeping. That's probably how they let Gideon's life insurance lapse. Michelle was an expert quilter and an organic cook, but if it had once been possible to turn one of these skills into a stream of income, there was no time for that now. Gideon's gadgets had been a failure, and it seemed unlikely that there would be seed money for another new business in the near future. The house would be gone soon, and a job brewing espresso or bagging groceries simply wasn't going to pay the rent and feed and clothe her children, even in the simple style that they had always embraced. Meanwhile, the Erickson's were not going to make things any easier. Michelle could not seriously believe that the Erickson's would take her children away from her. But she could not dismiss the possibility either, simply because of who they were, not just the oldest and wealthiest family around, but among the most powerful. The Erickson's influence circled Deer Creek, like a python strangling its prey. Anthony played chess weekly with the mayor. Erickson Timber employed hundreds of the residents. Natalie was on the board of every local charity that didn't espouse too left-wing a cause. Her favorite was one that helped foster children. "I still don't understand why you can't just sue the driver and get some money that way," Summer said plaintively. Michelle started to answer but was relieved when Courtney took over. "Summer," she began with a failed attempt at sounding patient, "have you ever heard the expression, 'You can't squeeze blood from a turnip'? The drunk wasn't insured, and he didn't have any money." "But isn't it a crime to drive without insurance?" "Yes," Courtney said. "It's also a crime to drive drunk. But even if this upstanding citizen goes to jail, and I hope to God he does, that's not going to put any money in Michelle's pocket. Michelle, what about your auto insurance?" "We just carry the minimal amount," Michelle said. "It'll just cover the funeral and a month of groceries. But..." "I know what you're going to say," Michelle interrupted. "We waived uninsured motorist coverage." The three were silent for a few moments. Michelle's gaze drifted out to Courtney's backyard again as she considered that the savings in their rather minuscule bank account was about to vanish forever. She absently watched as one of the season's last butterflies fluttered above the fading flowers. She wondered where the butterfly would seek shelter in the colder months, and if it would live to return in the spring. "You know, I just gotta get away," Michelle finally said, rather blankly. "Like where?" Courtney asked. "There's my Aunt Jenny up in Cheyenne. The kids adore her, but we don't get to see her very much, which is too bad, because she's pretty much the only extended family we have." Summer nodded encouragingly. Michelle's plan blossomed in front of her, giving her something to think about besides death and being harassed by her in-laws. "We can go today and stay over the weekend." "Go for it," Courtney agreed. "It'll do you good to get away." A couple of hours later, Michelle headed out to Eleanor Roosevelt Elementary, where Nikki was in second grade and Hannah had just started kindergarten. She had stopped at home and packed for herself and the kids, then filled the Chevy with gas. She and Gideon had not even owned the old van outright, and it didn't have much life left. She hoped it would get her to Wyoming that night. Pulling up to the cyclone fence around the playground, Michelle spotted Nikki and Hannah waiting at the main gate, as they always did, along with the other children who were waiting for rides home. Michelle bit her lip hard when she saw them. Nikki slumped against the fence while Hannah sat on the pavement, far away from the central group of children. They were both looking down. Hannah's hair, always a challenge to tame, looked ratted and tangled. Nikki's shirt was half tucked in and half drooping out. Michelle wondered, did she comb their hair that morning? Had any of them brushed their teeth in the past 12 days? They just lost their dad. For the sake of the children, she knew she had to get herself together. She was the grown-up. She didn't especially feel like behaving like one, but right now, she was going to do the best acting job of her life. She took her place in the line of cars parked alongside the school, put the van in park, then leaned across the front seat to roll down the window and flash her children with a cheery smile. "My lord and lady, your carriage awaits," she said playfully. Nikki and Hannah did not respond for a moment. Then they looked up and slowly registered her presence. Michelle jumped out and went around to slide open the door to the rear seat. She took a deep bow. "Your loyal servant has a surprise for you." Neither of the kids replied. They seemed to have barely enough energy to hoist themselves up into the van. "Put on your seat belts," Michelle reminded them. "Mom, what's going to happen?" Nikki finally asked as they drove away from the school. "I don't want to go live with Grandpa and Grandma. They're really strict." "Well, that I don't think you have to worry about, Nikki, honey." Perspiration made her hands feel slippery on the wheel. She had been edgy about driving since Gideon's death. "You might have to go see them sometimes." She had a feeling they were going to get court-mandated visitation. "But you'd want to go see them sometimes, wouldn't you?" Her voice cracked. She sought out their faces in the rearview mirror, which allowed her to see only the top right corner of Hannah's head and the left half of Nikki's face. Suddenly, Hannah dropped out of sight entirely. She had, Michelle knew, collapsed into Mr. Moo Moo, who was forbidden at school, but who had been waiting for her in the back seat. "This isn't the way home, Mom," Nikki said. "That's right," Michelle said.
Her voice was high-pitched with false good cheer. I just called your Aunt Jenny. We're going to visit her for the weekend. Driving northeast, the sun was behind them. Just before it set, they stopped at a roadside diner to eat. In the gathering dusk, the three of them got back in the van. Just before she pulled out of the parking lot, Michelle felt the first shallow waves of what she knew was a panic attack lapping at her, even though she had never had a panic attack. It was, as nearly as the police had ever pinpointed it for her, within a half hour of the time that Gideon had died. How would she see in the dark? What if the van broke down? When was the last time they had taken this jalopy in for a tune-up? The kids settled into their seats, full of greasy food and oblivious to her terror, or so she thought. Because suddenly Nikki asked, "Do you think Daddy's watching us now?" "Of course he is," Michelle replied, too loud and too eagerly, but feeling the relief flood over her and the panic recede. "Gideon, ask the Lord to protect me. I bet he really thinks you're great. Maybe that's why he couldn't wait to get you there. Tell him that joke about the skeleton who comes in the bar. Okay, maybe not that one." She popped in the Raffi tape that Hannah loved. Nikki complained that it was for babies. He wanted to hear the Backstreet Boys. "As soon as we get to Wyoming, we switch," she promised. 45 minutes later, it was completely dark, and she had her high beams on. A little of her nervousness had returned, but once they crossed into Wyoming, they'd only be another half hour away, and they'd easily arrive at Aunt Jenny's by 9. She was struck again by the impulsiveness of the trip, but it was like her to make last-minute plans, and she thought the kids had always enjoyed her spontaneity. She knew Gideon had. "There it is," she said. Her headlights reflected off the small green sign that told them they were entering the Equality State. "You know that Wyoming was the first state that gave women the vote," Michelle said. The silence in the back made her realize that her children had fallen asleep. She instinctively pushed the gas pedal a little harder, as if freedom waited on the other side of the sign, racing toward her. The road had been deserted, so she was startled a moment later to see the blinding red, blue, and yellow lights in her rearview mirror. She slowed down so the patrol car could pass her, but it didn't. What was wrong? She pulled over as quickly as she could safely slow the car. She rolled down the window and looked back. The brutal primary colors on the roof of the state trooper's car kept twirling, and the headlights stayed on too, casting two large cones of light into which a slim silhouette appeared a moment later. It was a tall, broad-shouldered state trooper, crunching the gravel on the side of the highway as he walked toward the van. She watched him, frozen, as he placed a hand on the hood and peered in the window silently. His flashlight did a quick search of the front and back seats. She noticed his Wyoming badge. "License? Registration?" "What?" Her mind went blank for a moment. She fumbled in her glove box. The trooper helped her by training his flashlight on the pile of maps, McDonald's toys, and additional kiddie cassettes that otherwise filled the compartment. "Here it is, officer," she said shakily. I wasn't speeding, was I?" The young trooper was holding the flashlight on her driver's license. "We had a report of a woman and two children attempting to cross state lines." "Mommy?" she heard Nikki's groggy voice. "Yes, sir," Michelle snapped defensively. "I am taking my children to visit a relative. Would you like her name and address?" "That won't be necessary, ma'am." His tone was matter-of-fact. "Apparently there is a protective order forbidding you from taking them out of state." Her brief semblance of bravado vanished. She wanted to beg, to plead, to offer him the few dollars in her purse. If he let her go, she would just keep driving. Wyoming was a big, empty state. She'd find a town that wasn't even on the map, get a job, start over from scratch, and make all her problems disappear. "Mommy!" Nikki was fully awake, and his single word was full of terror. Since he spoke softly, it must have been that terror that woke Hannah. "Mommy?" she whimpered. "It's all right, kids," Michelle said, though her voice was shaking. "Okay, officer, we'll turn around and go right home. You can even follow us if you want." The trooper shook his head. "I'm sorry, ma'am. You'll have to get out of the car."
She knew then everything that was going to happen. She stared ahead into the darkness of the state of Wyoming, the blankness of the prairie. Just drive away. Drive, drive, drive. As if she could outrun a police car in her old van.
Mommy, why is the policeman here?
Hannah was fully awake now, too.
What did they say in the old sci-fi movies?
Resistance is futile. It was only one of the many crazy things that went through her head as she got out of the van. It seemed to take forever, just the opening of the door, the long step down. Suddenly, there was the cold metal of the car against her hands and bare arms. Her baggy plum dress, the same one she had worn to the funeral, had short sleeves. The trooper had her up against the side of the van, spread-eagled. He was patting her down, his hands as indifferent as a shopper pawing through a sale rack. Through the closed rear window, in the giant cones of light from the Wyoming State Trooper's car, she saw Hannah's face wrench. She could see her crying, even though she couldn't quite hear. She also saw Nikki's big brown eyes fixed on her. Then he pulled his sister close, kissed her head, and hugged her. "Don't worry about the children, ma'am." A second trooper had taken over, and he guided her more gently than his partner had. "We'll take good care of them. We're taking them just as far as Greeley. Then they'll get a ride back to Deer Creek." Michelle wanted to thank him for the kindness in his voice, but all she could do was sob. When she reached the trooper's car, she was shocked to realize there was a second car behind the first one. This one had its lights out. She could just discern the outline of two more troopers sitting patiently in the front seat. She thought one might be a woman. She wondered if the woman might be a mother, too. Two state trooper vehicles patrolling a two-lane highway at least 40 miles from indoor plumbing. The work of Anthony Erickson. Monday evening, a private dinner in the fireside nook at the Mariposa Plaza, Riverdale's only four-star hotel. A cozy, dimly lit room that was set for 12. A flagstone hearth. Fake logs and a gas fire. 11 months had passed since Gideon's death. It was early August of the following year. Michelle felt like a French maid in a Noel Coward play, in her black uniform with its lace-trimmed white apron. She silently removed picked-over salads from the left of the diners. Damp radicchio and butter lettuce lay in the glistening remains of vinaigrette. She was good at laying the plates up her forearms, overlapping them slightly, to maximize the number she could carry at once. Her supervisor, Sarah, said she was a quick learner, but Michelle had forgotten how to take compliments. Back in the kitchen, she unloaded her arms. Sarah, a heavy-set Pacific Islander with a blue-black bun, instructed her to arrange the plates for the next course. "How's it going out there?" Jeremy asked. "Fine," she snapped. The old Michelle had not snapped. The new one did. "Chill, girl," Delphine said. Jeremy and Delphine, co-workers and, in Michelle's new world order, fellow losers. Jeremy Cavalieri had high cheekbones and a high-bridged nose, legacies from his Arapaho mother, and curly black hair, the contribution of his Italian father. Michelle had heard rumors that Jeremy had run a successful computer consulting business, but lost everything, even his family, to a gambling addiction. Delphine Dupre, who was also Michelle's roommate, had a tendency to make a splash at the Mariposa with her Tammy Faye makeup and her big hairdo, brown hair frosted in various shades of blonde and red, teased high on her head. She and Michelle lived in a one-bedroom apartment in a dreary complex with washing machines that never worked and a pool chronically filled with slime. Delphine shared the bedroom with her learning-disabled daughter, and Michelle had the fold-out couch in the living room. "Which group are we serving tonight?" Jeremy asked. "A bunch of rich people," Michelle said resentfully. "A group called EMC Cubed." Sarah was more specific. "It stands for Enlightened Millionaires Circle. They're a networking and service group of self-made millionaires, and they're excellent customers of the hotel, so be careful how you treat them. Now get out there and see who needs something more to drink." There was plenty of heat in the kitchen, and Michelle would have loved to be anywhere else but here. But she couldn't. It was her life. What was left of it? How blessed she had been.
She had thought that she'd appreciated what she used to have, her husband, her kids, even her modest home, but she hadn't. Was this God's way of teaching her a lesson? She had not lost her faith in God, not entirely, but if he did exist, he had some explaining to do. After her arrest, they had released her from jail on her own recognizance, of course. What would the Ericksons want more than for her to skip town? Within another 2 months, she had lost her house, her car, and her children, who had been placed in the temporary custody of their grandparents. Back when the Ericksons had first handed her the subpoena, she had foreseen that they would make trouble for her, but she had not really ever believed that she could lose her children. She had underestimated her in-laws. At the preliminary hearing, Judge Pedroni appeared to be an intelligent man, and Michelle could hardly believe that he was fooled by the parade of near strangers who claimed to have intimate knowledge of how she was an unfit mother. The proprietor of the local hardware store, who swore that he had seen her slapping Nikki when he asked her to buy him a toolkit. The landscaper who worked for a neighbor who said he repeatedly heard screams coming from the house. A doctor friend of the Ericksons who attended the wake and testified about the children's shabby appearance and Nick's bandaged forehead. The place was fit for pigs, the Ericksons' housekeeper claimed, raising an upper lip in repulsion. Natalie had so often sweetly insisted that she send Estella over for the day. Once, just once, Michelle had agreed. It was the week before Mother's Day, and Gideon was convinced that Natalie had meant it as a sincere gift. There were animal droppings everywhere, Estella testified, greatly exaggerating the number of pets the family kept. I wanted to throw up. In the courtroom, her friends did their best, but they were too few, and the legal system was ruled by a system of evidentiary rules so complicated that she couldn't imagine anyone with an IQ under 150 mastering them. Over and over, the stories her friends told about her volunteer work, her careful monitoring of her children's progress in school, and the positive example of her loving marriage were struck from the record on technicalities that eluded her, while somehow the Erickson psychologist's testimony that Hannah's attachment to Mr. Mumu only confirmed the presence of systematic abuse survived. At the nadir of the preliminary proceedings, Michelle still did not imagine that she would not get visitation. She did not even believe her attorney when he said that her visitation might be supervised. But Judge Pedroni cited her kidnapping attempt as evidence that she could not be trusted. He awarded temporary custody to the grandparents, pending a formal trial, which had yet to be scheduled. Michelle couldn't help but wonder if somehow Anthony Erickson had something to do with the glacial pace of the legal system, though she barely had any fight left in her. Michelle lived with her friend Summer for a while. She looked for work in Deer Creek and found it strangely, or not so strangely, difficult. Michelle spied on the children a few times at their new private school, St. James. Hannah's uniform was a white pleated skirt and midi top. Nikki wore a white polo shirt and navy trousers. Then, worried that she'd get caught and further jeopardize her chances at reclaiming the kids, Michelle cut short her trips to the St. James campus. She had Christmas dinner at Courtney's house. The food was excellent, and Courtney and her husband and young son were solicitous and charming. But she could hardly control her tears all evening, wondering what Nikki and Hannah were doing. She prayed that Natalie hadn't taken it upon herself to tell Hannah the truth about Santa Claus. After months of living so close but being forced to remain so far from her children, Michelle sank deeper into depression. Christmas was the breaking point. 2 weeks later, she moved to Riverdale, a town of 300,000 a half hour's drive from Deer Creek. She hoped the move would help her shed the paralyzing grief she still felt and jolt her into action so that she could focus on the upcoming custody battle. But she simply found herself growing angry in addition to feeling sad. Her bitter acorn of resentment, hurt, and humiliation grew into a mighty oak. She did not make new friends, and she cut short her old friends' calls, rarely getting together with Summer and Courtney. In general, men did not pursue her. Jeremy was an exception, but when he asked her out, her reply was rude enough that he did not ask a second time. Delphine was one of the few people, if not the only person, whom Michelle could tolerate. Perhaps it had to do with Delphine's struggles with her daughter. Mainly, though, Michelle moved in with Delphine to cut costs. Michelle wanted to hire another attorney, but that would take money. Even paying one-third rent, since she slept on the couch, it was still difficult to save. They took so much out of her paycheck. The hotel refused to stop deducting money for her health insurance, though she was willing to risk becoming sick in exchange for the extra cash. Michelle made the rounds of the EMC-cubed table. "More wine, sir?" she asked a man with a blonde mustache. "No, thank you." He covered his glass with his hand. Michelle picked up snippets of conversation about the NASDAQ, the Nikkei, P.E. ratios, and IPOs. Rich people. She thought of Anthony Erickson, and the wine bottle trembled in her hand. At one end of the table, she noticed a striking African-American woman dressed in a flowing African-style robe in blue streaked with gold that made Michelle think of the robes of a wizard. Her outfit was all the more arresting since the rest of the group was so conservatively, if expensively, dressed in dark suits, although pieces of gold jewelry flashed in the firelight. Michelle raised her eyebrows, extending her hand toward the woman's plate. The woman nodded absently. Michelle took it and then hesitated, not wanting to leave her side. She smelled of oranges and sandalwood. At the kitchen door, Michelle turned backward so that she could push it open with her rear end, since her arms were full. A pale, very thin woman at the end of the table, at the opposite end from where the African-American woman sat, stood up and began to address the group. "You all know Samantha Monroe, and you're dying to hear her, so I won't waste too much time on an introduction." Michelle knew immediately that the speaker would be the African-American woman. She was curious to hear her. The woman stood out like a tropical flower blooming in a patch of dry grass. And somehow, Michelle knew that her appearance was just the outward expression of what was inside. As with most people who promise to be brief, the speaker went on at some length. Michelle lingered as long as she dared at the door, even though she feared that someone exiting the kitchen would knock against her and send her plates flying. She learned that Samantha Monroe had just returned from a 3-month sojourn in Kenya. She was a founding member of EMC-cubed, a multi-millionaireess. She was wealthy from real estate, owned several businesses, and was also the author of 2 books. Finally, Michelle pushed the door open with her derriere. Delphine quickly took some of Michelle's plates. "We were about to send a search party. I'm kind of interested in the speaker," Michelle said tentatively. Jeremy and Delphine looked at each other. "You go ahead, honey," Delphine said. "We can cover for you." Michelle was embarrassed. She was only a lowly waitress, but at least her black uniform was designed for maximum invisibility. She sat on a chair next to the double doors and tried to project the impression that she was observing for the sole purpose of being available if anyone needed additional food or drink. But even as she was discreetly folding her hands in her lap and crossing her legs at the ankle, Samantha seemed to look directly at her. Michelle raised her chin. Now that she was standing, backlit by the fire, Samantha presented an even more imposing presence. She was taller than Michelle had anticipated, a stately woman with an ancient and ageless beauty whose long traditional dress did not hide the curves in her statuesque frame. Her hair was done in a massive weave with what seemed like thousands of delicate, tightly woven braids pouring like a fountain from under a headscarf that matched her robe. "My friends, I am so blessed to be here with you tonight. Can we join hands?" Her voice was a powerful contralto, commanding yet supple, like a saxophone. Everyone obeyed her request. Even in this circle of self-confident, accomplished millionaires,
Samantha was the natural leader. When she joined hands with her neighbors, Michelle could see that many of her long fingers were adorned with distinctive rings of hammered gold. We are blessed, and may we use our many blessings to bless many others, Samantha said simply. She released the hands of the two people on either side of her. All around the table, the chain collapsed, and yet Michelle felt the presence of an energy connecting them. I have two orders of business tonight. The first one is to give you all an update on our Millionaire Manifesto. At last month's meeting, Howard and I accepted the assignment of updating our mission statement. Samantha made a nod to a gentleman seated to her right. We finished a rough draft and would like to bounce it off you for your input. As she passed out a single piece of paper to all present, Samantha continued. For those of you who weren't with us when we formed EMC Cubed a few years ago, we wanted to create something unique from all of the other service groups. First, it would consist of only millionaires, but millionaires dedicated to doing good in the world. We wanted to celebrate prosperous people who took the higher road, to distinguish ourselves from the typical millionaire that people read about in the press, to put our emphasis on ethics, honesty, and integrity. That's why we called it EMC, the Enlightened Millionaire Circle. Second, we wanted it to be the ultimate masterminding group, to capitalize on the connections among and between us, to expand our network exponentially. It's true what they say. It's not what you know, but who you know. And I don't know of a more connected group than those of us in this room. Thus, exponential masterminding connections became another of our goals. And finally, we wanted to not only be enlightened and connected, but to have multiple streams of income. Thus, our three goals became EMC Cubed. The gentleman to the right of Samantha Howard spoke up. I thought of another meaning for EMC. Everyone makes cash. But Sam vetoed it. Samantha shot a mischievous scowl toward her counterpart, amid some hearty chuckles from the group. Then she went on. We decided to call our mission statement a manifesto, because it comes from the word manifest. Everything in your life is what you choose to manifest. Here is what we want to manifest: abundance for ourselves and for as many people on spaceship Earth as possible. When I think of abundance, I think of the bumblebee. He goes from flower to flower, collecting nectar. He's on a mission to gather nectar to support his hive, so he's already doing well. But in the meantime, he's also pollinating the whole garden. That's what entrepreneurs do. They make money, but in the process, they spin off new jobs and new products and lots of innovation. Thinking of bumblebees, Michelle remembered Courtney's beautiful garden. When she had left Deer Creek in January, it was covered in snow. But now, in August, the lilacs and petunias, the dancing butterflies of late summer. We're all bumblebees on this bus, Sam, chuckled a gray-haired man in suspenders. Exactly, Marshall, Samantha said, nodding to the fellow on her left. Bees do it by accident. We want to do it on purpose, because I'm sure you all agree, the ultimate purpose of wealth is to help others. Michelle's lips parted. She looked at Samantha. It looked as though the flames from the fireplace were rising from her head, like a phoenix being reborn. The rest of the room fell away. She thought of the Ericksons, how she had hated them for the way they used their wealth and influence to ruin her life. She had believed that wealth was the same as evil. She and Gideon were proud of not being materialistic, and Gideon wanted to be as different from his father as possible. So they had always lived on the edge. But in the end, they had hurt not only themselves, but, far worse, they had hurt Nikki and Hannah. They had demonized Gideon's parents for the wrong reason. Here, in this room,
were a group of millionaires who seemed to be different. What if there was a legitimate, kind, nurturing way to make money? What if she could make enough to hire the world's best attorney to help get her kids back? She felt a spark of hope flicker inside her for the first time in almost a year. She snapped out of her reverie. She'd missed a few words of what Samantha was saying. She wasn't going to let that happen again. Working with Howard, I got an exciting idea. Samantha paused and, with the subtlest possible movement of her head, seemed to make brief eye contact with everyone at the table. Ladies and gentlemen, you're the first to hear about the Enlightened Millionaire Training Manual. Murmurs of curiosity. I'm not famous for my modesty, and I'm not going to start now. I have assembled a manual that will teach people to become enlightened millionaires. I know that most of you have thought about how you became millionaires. For the past several years, I've been collecting my own list of principles for financial success. Just recently, I've pulled them together into one volume that anyone anywhere can pick up and use as a textbook for their own financial freedom. I wish I had something like that, Michelle thought. My goal is to create a million millionaires from this book. Michelle leaned forward. It's my way of giving back. Mark here taught me that one. She glanced over at a tall blonde gentleman in the far corner. Idea tithing. Isn't that what you called it, Mark? That's right, Mark agreed. It's about taking your best idea and giving it to the world. Like Irving Berlin gave the rights to his best song, God Bless America, to the Boy and Girl Scouts. You know, they've received over $5 million in royalties for that one. So, said Sam, this manual is my gift to the world. All the profits will go to my charitable foundation. This book is the culmination of 20 years of trial and error, mostly error. It's the shortcut that I wish someone had shown me when I got started. Do we get an advance copy? Asked the pale woman who had introduced her. Of course, on one condition, that you help me find some, well, guinea pigs, for a lack of a better term. People to test this material on. Like those family members who are more interested in spending your money than making some of their own. At this reference, Michelle unconsciously moved to the edge of her seat. She felt a tiny idea pecking at her, like a chick trying to break its way out of an egg. Michelle, someone whispered behind her. Michelle jumped to her feet. It was Jeremy, peering out through a crack in the double doors. Chief Sarah's on the warpath. Right. How could Cinderella have forgotten her place in the kitchen? She reluctantly ducked back inside. The last dish was put away, the last counter wiped. But still, out in the dining room, the members of EMC Cubed lingered, mostly gathered around Samantha. Sarah delegated Michelle and Delphine to go into the fireside room to strip the tablecloth, a not-so-subtle reminder that the room needed to be cleaned. Michelle's heart was pounding as she folded the cloth with Delphine. Folding was silly since the cloth was bound for the laundry, but she was stalling. It was Samantha who took the hint of Michelle and Delphine's activities. "Let's let these folks get home," she said to the two men and three women who still clustered around her, then motioned with her head toward the door. Delphine, Michelle whispered, I've got a big favor to ask. Could you finish cleaning up without me? I need to do something. Sure. Trying not to think about how furious Sarah would be with her, Michelle rushed back to the employee lockers, removed her apron, grabbed her purse, and went searching for Samantha Monroe. Out the door, down a hallway, into the lobby. Had Samantha gone already? No, thank God. She was sitting on a circular banquette, flanked by the pale woman who had introduced her and the man in suspenders, whom Michelle recognized from EMC Cubed. Michelle stopped about 10 feet away. Her heart was pounding. It's for Nikki and Hannah. She forced herself to take the final steps. The three on the banquette looked up. Ms. Monroe, Michelle blurted out, I think I can help you. Samantha gazed steadily at Michelle. You're the waitress from the dinner, aren't you? She observed leisurely, but kindly, Yes, Michelle squirmed, but don't hold it against me.
Why would I do that, miss?
I don't know. Ms. Monroe, I was listening to your speech. I think you have a really incredible idea.
Me too. What calm, what confidence radiated from Samantha Monroe.
You were talking about guinea pigs, Michelle reminded her, for your training manual.
Samantha gave her that mysterious one-corner-up smile that Michelle remembered from her talk in the fireside room. She felt the stirrings of hope.
What's your name, young lady?
Michelle Erickson. Tell you what, Michelle Erickson. When the book is printed, I'll send you one of the first copies off the press. Why don't you give me your business card?
I don't have a card, Michelle said a bit shortly.
Well then, here's my card. Call my office and give your address to my assistant, and I'll make sure to send you a copy.
Michelle took the card. It was simple yet elegant, a black card with gold embossed lettering and the logo of a phoenix. A phoenix.
Samantha nodded her head as if to say, "We're done now," and returned to her previous conversation with her companions.
Michelle stood there awkwardly and tucked the card into her blouse pocket. She didn't know what she had expected, but she felt dismissed. Still, she couldn't bring herself to leave. After a moment, Samantha rose gracefully from the banquette and turned to leave. Michelle heard her say goodbye to the others, who headed in different directions. Michelle watched her go until she disappeared through the sliding glass doors of the Mariposa Plaza.
Wait, Michelle called. When Michelle caught up with her, Samantha was waiting under the porte cochere, presumably for the valet to bring her car. She turned calmly toward Michelle.
I see you've handled the first rejection.
Michelle wrinkled her brow.
The first rejection, Sam repeated. Most people can't handle the first rejection. That's why they never get rich.
Michelle nodded, beginning to understand.
Sam continued, leaning forward as if to share a secret. It's after the third rejection where the big money is made. By this time, the attendant had brought the keys to Sam's car, a deep green Mercedes with sparkling chrome wheels. Sam turned to walk toward her car.
But, Michelle called after her, Samantha glanced over her shoulder. It will all be explained in the book I'll send you.
Samantha tossed her briefcase into the back seat, and just before she slipped into the leather front seat, Sam looked back and held up her two fingers toward Michelle. A peace sign?
Michelle stood there helpless. It was all happening so fast. Somehow she knew that this woman was the key, the missing number of the combination to the vault, the way to get her life back on track. All she could think of was her two children being raised by those stuffy, conniving Ericksons, and something bubbled out of her, a renewed strength she hadn't felt in months.
Wait! She called out.
The car stopped, and the driver's side window rolled down. Samantha looked out.
I'm it, Michelle blurted out. I'm your guinea pig. I don't need to read your book. I'm ready now. I need it now.
She spoke with a sense of focus and power that surprised even herself.
I'm sorry, Ms. Erickson. I just don't have the time.
Samantha stayed there, slightly smiling, her car not moving, the window still rolled down, almost as if she were waiting for Michelle to speak. Now Sam held up three fingers. And then Michelle understood the game that Sam was playing with her.
That's the third rejection, isn't it?
Samantha smiled. She gestured slightly with her head toward the passenger side door. Michelle ran around the front of the Mercedes and jumped onto the buttery leather seat next to Samantha. The smell of new car washed over her. She looked over at Sam. Sam returned her gaze with another slight nod, as if tipping her hat in respect.
You learn fast, Missy.
Sam put the car in gear, and off they drove into the cool Colorado night. When Michelle awoke, she didn't immediately remember where she was. Then the branches of the crabapple tree outside the window came into focus. Samantha Monroe's house. Michelle had been surprised when Sam had driven up to the nondescript two-bedroom bungalow on the outskirts of Riverdale. "This was my first investment property," Sam had explained. "I figure this will be an excellent place to begin our training." The guest room that Michelle now occupied was small, painted white, and looked suited for a young girl. Photos of Sam's own extended family and some nieces and nephews of her late husband adorned the dresser. Michelle wondered, would she ever have a place to put pictures of her own up again? No matter where she lived, it wouldn't be a home without Nikki and Hannah. For a while, she hadn't even let herself think about them. She had cut off her feelings, the way she used to prune back her plants. But now, she almost dared to hope again. In the early morning quiet, she began reflecting on the affirmations. Sam called them manifestations, that Sam had already instructed Michelle to do first thing each day. I am rich. I am successful. I am standing under the spout where all good things pour out. She felt a little silly even repeating them silently in her mind. Samantha must know what she's talking about. It'll happen, came a voice. Michelle sat up, startled. Samantha was in the doorway, dressed in dark green jogging pants and a matching sweatshirt. A dime store bandana replaced her usual headscarf. How did you? Samantha laughed. Intuition. Come on, private. It's time for your morning drills. If you're going to live here, it's not gonna be to laze in bed till all hours. All hours? It's 6 a.m. What do you bet that daddy-in-law of yours is eating some venture capitalist for breakfast by now? Michelle jumped out of bed. 5 minutes later, she had brushed her teeth and put on the old sweats and running shoes that she had retrieved from her apartment the night before. Samantha was outside, at rest in her porch swing. Samantha, you can call me Sam. And Sam was on her feet, the porch swing rocking behind her. Without looking back, she skipped one of the three steps down to the sidewalk, took a left, and hit the ground running. Michelle felt a surge of adrenaline. She and Gideon used to run together. She hadn't been out since then. She was out of shape, but surely... We'll be running every morning, Sam called back over her shoulder. The sun wasn't yet strong enough to burn through the early morning mist. Sam led the way down the quiet suburban street. By the time they took a right 10 minutes later, the gap between Michelle and Sam was nearly a half a block long, and Michelle suspected that Sam wasn't going at full speed. You'd better put the pedal to it, Sam shouted, this time without looking back. I'm trying, she puffed. This new street ended in a park. Sam ran straight across the grass toward a narrow paved path. Michelle, feeling the oxygen leaching from her muscles, willed herself to follow. They passed picnic tables and a large play structure, but there were no children out yet, only a few joggers on the path that she now joined behind Sam. Keep it up! Michelle looked up at the wooded hill ahead of them with a feeling of dread, but Sam didn't slow, and as the path began to climb, Sam did too. Soon they were entering a stand of pine trees that became denser as they went on. Michelle kept her eyes on her prize in the green sweats. Then suddenly, Samantha disappeared. She had left the path. Michelle was afraid she had lost her. But after a moment, she caught sight of her darting among the trees, heading in a direction that she seemed to have memorized. Michelle continued her pursuit, wheezing harder than before as she kept pushing uphill. Then, just as she felt her second wind giving out, she saw light breaking through the trees beyond. A few moments later, she followed Sam into the open. It was as if she had stepped out into another world. Sam was standing on a flat outcropping of rock, a promontory that extended beyond the thick line of trees. Her arms were stretched wide toward the sky. A valley dipped below her. It was deep and narrow, drenched in early morning sunshine and alive with yellow dots that Michelle guessed were black-eyed Susans. A bright creek coursed through the bottom. The forest was awakening with the sounds of blue jays and skittering squirrels, and in the distance, the Rocky Mountains rose in all their blue majesty. This place is blessed, this day is blessed, and we are all blessed, Sam shouted out over the valley.
I don't remember a Samantha Monroe winning an Olympic gold medal in track.
Michelle, holding on to her side, finally had enough breath to speak.
Before your time, butterfly, Samantha chuckled.
She continued to gaze over the valley.
Come out here on the point with me.
Michelle chose her footing carefully among the rocks until she reached a flat spot near the edge. She leaned over. The drop looked to be about 100 feet. She quickly took a few steps back, feeling dizzy.
Now stand up straight, Sam coached, looking straight at her, down from her extra 6 inches with kindness and love.
I want you to take a slow, deep breath, the deepest breath of your life.
Michelle closed her eyes and concentrated on pulling in a massive quantity of the pure mountain oxygen. She held it for a long time and then slowly exhaled every last molecule.
Perfect. Do that again, but even slower this time. Breathe in all the good things and breathe out all the things you fear.
Michelle allowed herself to be coached through 7 all-purifying breaths. When she completed the last and longest breath, her face was flushed and her skin was zinging. She opened her eyes, almost tipsy with excess energy.
Wow!
She scanned the horizon with renewed appreciation. Come over here and sit down by me, Sam coaxed. Michelle saw that Sam was pointing to a huge stone, almost as smooth as a table, to their left. Sam slid easily onto the edge, then scooted over to make room for Michelle and patted the space beside her. After another uneasy glance down, Michelle joined her. She swung her legs over the side.
I've always been a little scared of heights, she admitted.
Time to get over it, was Sam's response. Gideon was the one who took Nikki on all the amusement park rides, Michelle remembered. Hannah was more like me that way. Sam leaned over and picked up a shiny yellow-brown pine cone from among several that were scattered around them. A lot of getting over fear is just doing what you're afraid of. And as the crisp breeze ruffled her hair, and she watched the stream below glimmer in the ascending sun, Michelle did feel her fear recede.
Sam lobbed the pine cone into the valley.
There'll be a lot of new scary things to try, if you really want to be a millionaire.
Well, I do, Michelle said firmly.
What would you do with all that money?
First, I'd fight to get my kids back.
And then?
Then I'd make them pay for what they did.
Them?
Yeah, the people who ruined my life. Like that drunk driver, she nearly spat. Michelle caught something odd in Sam's tone, but she barreled on. And the Ericksons. I'd like them to know what it's like to sleep on someone's couch for 6 months.
So you want revenge?
Works for me, Michelle agreed. Because they ruined your life.
Michelle squirmed. Well, they did ruin my life, she said sulkily.
There is only one person who can ruin your life, and that's you.
This made Michelle angry. She glared back, stabbing a finger toward the other woman.
My husband was killed by a drunk driver. That's a fact. His parents stole my children. That's a fact. I lost my house. That's a fact.
I don't dispute your facts, counselor, Sam said as if she were a judge in a courtroom scene. But you get to decide whether these facts make you a victim or a victor. And right now, you're acting like a victim.
But I am a victim.
Missy, every one of us is a victim of something, but some people don't act like victims. I have a friend who's a quadriplegic. Do you know what he does for a living? He draws cartoons with a pen he holds between his teeth.
Michelle looked down at the valley. It suddenly seemed even deeper.
And you're telling me this because?
Because my friend is not a victim. He's a victor. A victim blames. A victor learns.
Michelle looked down at her knees.
What is there to learn from losing everything? She asked. You tell me. Michelle blinked back tears. I learned that I don't like rich people.
Hey, Sam teased. I'm rich.
Michelle retreated hastily. I learned that I don't like some rich people.
What else did you learn?
Sam tossed another pine cone over the edge. Michelle was silent. She didn't like this game. Sam prodded her.
Did you learn that you could survive?
Michelle nodded, grudgingly.
Did you learn that you loved your family more than your own life?
Michelle blinked again, but this time the tears came anyway. But if Sam noticed them, they didn't slow her down. You take it from here. Michelle whispered,
I learned that I'd do almost anything to get them back.
And? Sam prompted. Michelle thought for what seemed like a long time. It hurt to get the words out.
I learned that I need to take care of business. If I hadn't let the insurance lapse, that was a hard lesson, Sam said gently.
Michelle pondered for a moment. Here's something else I learned, that I'm not very good with money.
Sam spoke in a mocking tone. Poor me. I didn't get the money, Jeans, so I guess I'll always be poor.
Well, I'm not good with money.
Let's suppose that you're right. Do you want to be right, or do you want to be rich?
Michelle reflected on this.
Anybody can learn to be good with money, Samantha said. I believe that even you can do it, if you choose. Ultimately, the victors are the ones who figure out what went wrong and rearrange their life so that it never happens again. Otherwise, life just keeps throwing the very same lesson at you until you get it. My daddy always used to say, the third time you get bitten by a dog, you can know one thing for sure. It ain't the fault of the dog.
Michelle smiled. Sam picked up another pine cone. This one she chucked to Michelle. Do you know anything about these? Michelle tossed the cone once in the air.
Hannah would say that's where baby pine trees come from.
She's right. That pine cone comes from the lodgepole pine. Sam pointed out a stand of tall, straight trees ringing the edge of the valley.
The kind your father-in-law lusts to turn into two-by-fours.
Michelle's face darkened. Inside that pine cone are thousands of seeds. Do you know what finally releases them?
When the male pine cone pays for dinner?
No, Sam laughed. The seeds are only released by a wildfire.
Really?
Wildfires are part of nature's renewal process. Sam reached over to touch the pine cone without taking it from Michelle's hand. Every 100 years or so, a wildfire roars through these woods, and the heat is so intense that these cones explode, and that releases the seeds for a brand new forest.
After a pause, Sam went on. Sometimes people have wildfires. It takes a while, but things grow back.
Michelle wrapped her hands around the shiny cone.
Let's get up and walk.
A little reluctantly, Michelle pulled herself to her feet.
Yes, this is a special place, Samantha said. By now, Michelle was used to having Samantha read her thoughts. I call it the rock. I take it with me everywhere I go. Metaphorically speaking, she added with a chuckle, I recommend you do too.
Michelle followed as Sam climbed back over the stony ground to the more welcoming earth of the forest. Michelle's muscles were ready to move again, and she enjoyed the more leisurely pace, with time to admire the silvery leaves of the blooming wild sage and to spot butterflies. The sight of one prompted Michelle to ask,
Sam, why did you call me Butterfly?
Because you are a butterfly, Sam replied, once you get out of that cocoon. Sam fell quiet again, and Michelle sensed that she was giving her time to absorb some of the matters they had discussed. After a while, Sam began to ask casual questions about Michelle. Soon she responded in kind by telling Michelle some of her own life history. Sam had had her own wildfires. She had always wanted to have children, and she and her husband had tried for years through many miscarriages. Then, her 42-year-old husband succumbed to a brain tumor. After caring for him through his illness, Sam was as broke as Michelle. But she managed to buy the small house in Riverdale. From that start, she had built a mini empire with properties and businesses in 5 western states. Sam focused the energy she had hoped to lavish on her own children to fostering at least 1 deep mentoring relationship every year. This helped Michelle understand why a successful business person like Sam, already so extended in her commitments, had agreed to take her on. Finally, Sam led Michelle back to the promontory. Michelle was happy to see the breathtaking vista again. The sun was a little higher. Once again, they picked their way to the edge. Sam stood on the flat rock and motioned for Michelle to join her. The height still made Michelle's heart beat a little faster, but this time there was more thrill than fear. They stood on the point together, Sam's arm on Michelle's shoulder. "So, Michelle Erickson, let me ask you again. After you get your kids back, what will you do with $1 million? Michelle's voice was low and hard. "I'd get my finances so strong that no one would ever be able to hurt me or my family again." "Good," said Sam. "What else do you want?" "Dream," she added in a whisper. Michelle looked over the horizon as she described what she began to see in her mind. "I'd buy a farm. Not a working farm. I don't want to churn butter or grow corn. But I want a big, big place with lots of rooms and lots of land so we can have all the pets we want and the biggest garden in the world. What else? Isn't that enough?" "Does it have to be? Why can't you have everything you want? Is it hurting someone if you do?" "No." "So, just keep going. Tell me, just how good could your life be? It's not just about money now." Michelle shook her head. "I don't want to do this." "You don't want to get your hopes up?" "No." Sam leaned closer. "Look," she said in a stage whisper. "There's nobody here but us chickadees. Take a chance. Let yourself dream. How good could it be?" Michelle hesitated. "Go for it," Sam pushed. "Okay," Michelle began slowly. "We have that farm, and the kids are back with their old friends, and they have new ones. Hannah isn't so shy anymore. They love school, and they get all A's." She paused for breath. "Keep going." "They have all the clothes and toys and books they want, but they're learning to give back, too." The little hopes were sprouting up in her like the black-eyed Susans in the valley. "We travel. All the places we've all wanted to go. And Hannah has the lead in the school play. And Nikki is the best shortstop that Deer Creek ever saw. And who's responsible to make that happen?" "I am." Sam nodded. "Now that's how a victor talks. I can work with that." "Great." Michelle let out a happy sigh. "Oh, you're not done yet, butterfly," Sam winked. "One more thing. Now you need to shout it."
"I beg your pardon?
Tell the universe out loud." Suddenly, Michelle understood. She looked across the valley, spreading out before them at the mighty Rocky Mountains. She stretched out her arms.
"I want..."
"No, say it as if it's happening now." Michelle filled her lungs to bursting. Then she called across the valley,
"I'm with my children."
She was startled to hear it come back to her with almost the same intensity.
"Children, children,"
the echo. "Go on."
"We live on a great big farm."
"Big farm."
"With lots of pets."
"Pets."
"And we are as happy and successful as we could ever imagine."
She kept her arms stretched out wide, alone with Sam on the very top of the world, listening to the final words of the echo. "Imagine, imagine, imagine." Over the next week, Michelle and Samantha followed the same routine. Up at 6, they jogged out to the rock. Each day, Michelle found the trek a little bit easier, until on the 7th day, she raced ahead of Sam and beat her to the promontory by a good 60 seconds. When she heard Sam break through the woods behind her, Michelle was at the end of the point, shouting out her goals, her hands up in the air like Rocky at the top of the Philadelphia courthouse stairs.
"Great job, Missy!"
Samantha called her approval. Michelle suspected that her new friend had cut her a little slack, but it still felt good. After enjoying the view silently for a few moments and catching their breath, Samantha motioned with her head toward the flat rock. She proceeded to lie down, folded her hands behind her head, and crossed her legs at the ankle. Then she let out a contented sigh. Dr. Freud was on to something, having people lie down to get themselves analyzed. She looked over at Michelle. "Come on, butterfly, join me." The sun shone on Michelle with comforting warmth, and the sun-bathed rock also sent its heat flowing back upward into her body. But it was so much more than physical warmth. She felt at peace for the first time, not just since Gideon's death, but in a way that she had rarely felt in her life before. A calming presence encircled her. She associated it with Sam. She knew it was brought to her by Sam, but it was so much more than Sam, too. "Where do we start today?" Michelle asked, after a few moments of silence. "Midterm." "Oh, boy," Michelle rolled her eyes. "Don't worry, it's an oral test. Tell me about the ahas you've had this week." Michelle immediately knew what Sam was talking about. They'd spent many hours talking about the ahas of the enlightened millionaire. Sam had taught her that it was one thing to learn a lesson intellectually, but quite another to get it emotionally. Without that flash of insight, the aha experience, the lesson wasn't complete. Sam called it transformational learning, as opposed to informational learning. Heart learning versus head learning. It meant using metaphors and games and various exercises until the lights came on. Sam had told her that it wasn't enough to get an aha. It was just as important to share the aha with someone else as soon as possible. In this way, the lesson was learned at a deeper level. Michelle scanned back over the week, reviewing her favorite ahas. "Givers get," she said. "That was a new concept for me. I always thought of rich people as stingy, penny-pinching, money-grubbing. But you showed me how I could give my way to wealth. I like that." "Give me another aha," Sam prodded. "Writing down my goals every day," Michelle replied immediately. "The first few times I did it, I heard that voice in my head. Do you mean Ms. Yabut?" Samantha smiled. Michelle nodded. "I'd start writing a goal, like getting Nikki and Hannah back." She flinched, but found she could go on. "And I'd hear that voice saying, 'Yeah, but it's too late. Yeah, but you're not smart enough. Yeah, but you'll never get the money.'" "Whoa, you're good at yeah, buts." "Yeah, but I had a good teacher," Michelle laughed, "who gave me one of these." Michelle held up her slender, freckled forearm, now tanned from her week outside. From it dangled a purple rubber band. "This is my second one. I snapped the other one so many times it broke." "Ouch!" Samantha winced. She took Michelle's wrist and silently regarded the faint red mark above her watch. "I'm still snapping, but not nearly as much." Samantha let go of Michelle's wrist. "That'll be gone by next week, along with Ms. Yabut." For the next 15 minutes, Sam reviewed Michelle's goals with her, coaching her to visualize each of her goals in full sensory detail, as if she were experiencing them in present time. Although Michelle was beginning to feel more confident about the future, something was nagging at her, an underlying worry she was having trouble putting into words. Finally, she asked Sam about it. "Learning these ahas has been great, but I was wondering..." Michelle struggled to avoid offending her mentor. "When are we going to get to the millionaire stuff?" Sam must have heard the question but didn't immediately respond. She continued to stare at the clouds. It appeared to Michelle that she was pondering how to answer. Sam finally spoke, her voice low and deep. This is the millionaire stuff. The way she said it, Michelle got the impression that Sam was a bit disturbed by the question.
Yeah, but...
And then Michelle caught herself and snapped her rubber band. Sam picked up on it. What was the thought? You just snapped.
I just keep telling myself that this is going too slow. I don't have time for ahas. I need to get to the money-making stuff. You know, how to buy real estate, how to launch a business, how to make $1 million.
Have you ever noticed how quickly skyscrapers seem to go up? Sam asked. What you don't see are years of advanced planning with the architect and the general contractor. Then they spend months excavating the soft soil and then driving steel columns or piles, sometimes hundreds of feet deep until they reach bedrock. The taller the building, the deeper the piles. As for your building, I'd say we're still in the excavation phase. Michelle was silent for several minutes.
How do you know so much about buildings?
Well, my office building isn't a skyscraper, just 10 stories, but the principles are the same. Michelle leaned up on her elbow, impressed.
You own a 10-story office building?
Yep, me and the bank, she chuckled. Then, after a short silence, Sam spoke softly.
Just trust me, Missy. The money'll come, faster than you can imagine. But first, the foundation.
Okay, said Michelle, feeling like a child who has just been told that there'll be no dessert unless she finishes her vegetables. Sam launched ahead. When was the last time you just knew something was right?
That's easy, when I met you.
No extra credit for buttering up the teacher.
Seriously.
But how did you know? Samantha twisted one of the hammered gold rings she wore on her fingers. What did it feel like when you met me? Not just in your head, in your body. Michelle closed her eyes and took herself back to the Mariposa Plaza. That night she felt so desperate and alone. She remembered how that felt well enough, from morning until night. The heaviness in her body, the dimness of the world, as if she were wearing sunglasses all the time.
I'm not sure. Go back to that experience. Relive it.
Notice the subtle things that were going on. Michelle kept her eyes closed. She saw again the flames of the fire lapping behind Samantha. She remembered details she hadn't been consciously aware of before, because there had been so many other things going on in her mind at the time. Take yourself forward frame by frame, Sam coached. As Michelle followed Samantha's instructions, reliving that night, she felt as though she were seeing a movie for the second time and picking out elements she had missed on the first viewing. And then she noticed something. She spoke as if she had been thinking aloud.
There is this tiny voice in my head whispering, "This is it. Go for it."
"Ms. Yabbitts?" Sam asked. Michelle shook her head.
"No, not that voice. Another one."
"How did this new voice make you feel?"
Peaceful all over my body, and lighter.
Michelle continued to reenact the scene up to the moment when she got into Samantha's Mercedes. "Where is the feeling now?"
"Right here."
Michelle opened her eyes wide, then squinted in the sunlight. She tapped her chest.
"In my heart."
Samantha propped herself up on one elbow. "Some people call it intuition. I call it your true self. Now you know what it sounds like and how it makes you feel."
Michelle nodded. "Where did you learn this?"
"From my grandfather." Sam smiled, remembering. "He was a very successful businessman. One day, I was about 14, I observed him in a business meeting in his living room. I noticed that whenever he was asked to make an important decision, he paused, pursed his lips, put his hand on his heart, and tapped 3 times. Then he rendered his decision. Afterward, I asked him about it. He said he always checked with his true self before he made up his mind about anything important."
"So what does your intuition tell you is the next step?" Sam asked.
This book is continued on Disc 7.